you're going to fly by that ship, you're going to hack into it, and you're going to rendezvous with the dropship. Then you are going to do everything you can to stop that surveyor ship. May I point out the glaringly obvious flaw in your plan, you brainless monkey? The fact that without the jetpack, I'm going to hit the atmosphere and burn up. Yeah, I know that, Skippy. I don't need to be reminded of that. Thank you very much. Shit. Joe, this is the second time you've offered to sacrifice yourself for a noble cause. The first time I offered to sacrifice myself for you, you little shithead. No cause could be more noble indeed. I offered to sacrifice myself for you because you're more valuable to the mission than I am. The Dutchman can go on without me. Chang will make a fine commander. That surveyor ship can be stopped without me. But it can't be stopped without you. Unless I'm missing something here. No. Astonishing as it may seem, your logic is correct on this one. Damn, why does the monkey pick now to start using logic? Despite the situation, he made me smile. I love you too, Skippy. You see an alternative? If we use the jetpack to rendezvous with the dropship, by the time we get there, those two tankers will have jumped away already, and we'll never find them. We will lose our one chance to intercept that surveyor ship before it reaches Earth. It will take the tankers longer than you think to reach a safe jump distance. This planet has a deep gravity well, and they are heavily loaded with fuel. You are correct, however, that this is the only opportunity I see for being able to track these ships and locate the surveyor. Right. I breathed heavily and unintentionally fogged the faceplate for a second. Is there any way to get you to within 4,000 kilometers of that ship and also make sure I don't hit the atmosphere? Can we split the difference? Use the jetpack to move both of us just enough so I miss the planet, then you fly off to intercept the tanker? Skippy replied immediately, which was a bad sign. If there was any chance for both of us to get out of this, he would have paused a split second to run a couple million calculations. Given the laws of physics, which I can't screw with because those tankers would detect us, the answer is unfortunately no. Joe, I'm sorry. You have nothing to be sorry about. I know that. Sorry is something you monkeys say is a social courtesy, whether you mean it or not. That custom seems particularly stupid now. I appreciate the effort, Skippy. All right. Before I change my mind, I was deliberately not looking at the planet ahead. Can you program the jetpack to fly you near that tanker, and I'll engage it with this controller on my wrist? I don't like this, Joe. I'm not jumping for joy about it either, Skippy. Jetpack autonomous navigation system has been programmed. Ready. He simulated taking a deep breath. Are you sure about this, Joe? It seems like such a waste. Skippy, I'm a soldier. I knew the risks coming out here. My voice choked up a bit, and I paused to swallow hard. I'm not going to do nothing and let that surveyor ship reach Earth. If you have a better idea, I'm all ears. Legitimately, no. No, I do not have any other idea. Joe, there is a big difference, or there should be, between taking a risk of dying and taking an action that will result in certain death. Suicide does not seem like something a soldier would do. Skippy, let's get real here, okay? Yeah, in a way, this is suicide. But really, it is only an issue of timing. You'll need to explain that one. This whole mission is suicide. I explained that to everyone before we left Earth. Be straight with me. What are the odds we humans can fly the Dutchman back to Earth by ourselves after you leave us for collective heaven, or whatever the hell it is you're looking for? Zero. Well, close enough to zero that your chances of success are statistically insignificant. If you like, I can recite the actual odds to 100 decimal points. However, I expect you are satisfied with meh-level math on this one. You got that right. Captain Desai has become a skilled starship pilot for, you know, a monkey. And she has trained other pilots well enough for basic maneuvers. My calculation of your odds are no reflection on your merry band of pirates. They are all dedicated, and considering your species' miserably low level of development, reasonably intelligent, no offense. Inside my helmet, I had to smile and roll my eyes. In one sentence, he insults us and says he intended no offense. Sometimes I wondered about his intelligence. He continued, "The problem is the Flying Dutchman is an incredibly complex machine, and you humans have no idea how it works, not really. If anything goes wrong, there is zero possibility you can fix it. Even routine maintenance, which I have been doing for you using Theranin robots, is beyond your capabilities. The jump drive coils, for example, will drift out of calibration each time you jump. Without me fine-tuning the jump system, I estimate the drive will become unusable within 20, certainly 25 jumps. Jumps that you program will be so inaccurate that you will have no realistic chance to emerge near a wormhole. You'd have to jump as close as you can and fly through possibly half a light-year of normal space to where a wormhole is going to open. Frankly, you will run out of time and food before you got home. Although by that time the jump drive would be so hopelessly screwed up you would not be able to jump at all anyway. Is there any way you can load a submind into the ship's computer to take care of that maintenance stuff for us after you leave?
Ha! Ha! No way, dude, Skippy laughed.
The memory and processing power on the Dutchman are much too small to contain a stable submind. It might work fine for a week, maybe two. Then it would start going funky on you, and without me to adjust it, the submind would go senile and destroy the ship. So, no to that one. Before you ask, I could reload the original Theranin AI into the computer, modified to work with you instead of wiping you out as soon as it became aware of your presence. That would not help. The Theranin's cyborg nature is integrated into their AIs to such an extent that the AI cannot completely control the ship without them. That is both because the Theranin wish their minds to be as close as possible to an AI, and because the Theranin don't want an AI to be able to run the ship without them for security reasons. Especially because the Theranin are quite rightly concerned about the Max-Hulks hacking into their systems. Many crucial control and maintenance functions require cyborg participation, particularly in controlling the robots. Humans can't fill the role of the Theranin, and the system's processing substrate lacks the capacity for me to replicate the cyborg function inside it.
Uh-huh. Like I said before, this whole fool's errand is a suicide mission, and me falling into this planet is only shortening the trip somewhat for me. Unfortunately, I am forced to agree with your point. I still do not like it.
Joe, I need to understand something. You came out here knowing there is almost no possibility that you will ever return to Earth. Why? Why did you come with me?
Yeah, the short answer is that you had that wormhole on a timer, and if we didn't come out here with you, there would be a whole lot of pissed-off lizards and little green men coming to Earth and asking awkward questions. Beyond that, I came out here because I promised you that I would. It's that simple. We have a bargain. You sure kept your end of it. This is my end of the deal. We owe you, Skippy. We humans owe you more than we can ever repay. Billions of humans are safe today because of you. I understand you don't belong with us, that you need to go home or find answers about who you are and where you came from.
You monkeys are more complicated than I expected.
Yep, sure. Now I'll give you a little push so you can drift away before I engage the jetpack.
Yes, it would be best if you were at least 80 meters away before the jetpack fires thrusters.
There not being much left to say, I hugged the jetpack tight to my chest, then pushed it away, trying not to make it wobble or spin. My best effort left it turning ever so slowly, and left me spinning also. In a maneuver I had practiced during training, I used my arms and legs to halt my spin so that Skippy and the jetpack were off to my left, and I was facing the planet. Facing it. Facing it right there. Damn, it looked close already.
Hey, Skippy, should I go silent now? You're taking the micro wormhole with you, right?
You are now outside the stealth field, so yes, you should cease even your low-power transmissions. I will send a tight beam message to you after I fly by the tanker. That should be within the next 27 minutes. Soon after I fly past the tanker, it will go behind the horizon of the planet, and we can communicate again, about 40 minutes from now. I almost said goodbye before catching myself at the last moment. Talk to you then, Skippy.
Man, that was a long 40 minutes. On the display inside the helmet faceplate, I was able to track the two tanker ships. They were big, they were close, and they weren't using stealth. In fact, their crews were chatting and exchanging data almost continuously. It would have been impossible not to notice them. Of Skippy and the dropship, hidden inside their stealth fields, I saw and heard nothing. The planet kept growing larger until it completely filled my view. In order to see the darkness of space, I had to turn my head. And darn it, the view was eerily beautiful. The planet below me was mostly orange in color. When I left the dropship, from that far away it had been an orange blob the size of a basketball. Now I was close enough to see details, and it looked like a creamsicle, swirls of orange and white, with less prominent streaks of purple, light browns and greens. The planet didn't have a big spot like Jupiter had. The cloud formations were more subtle. Great swaths of darker or lighter clouds stretching across an entire hemisphere. Some of the clouds below were moving so fast I could see them changing as I watched. It was hypnotic. Clouds swirling and spinning and merging with each other and splitting apart. The speed at which the upper atmosphere was moving must have been mind-boggling. This is one case when I wished I could talk with Skippy so he could bore me with sciencey details. Right then, it would have been good to talk with anyone. I'd never felt so alone in my life. Even when my dropship was frozen inside a comet, I had at least been in a familiar environment. Walls, floors, ceiling, seats, displays and controls, and a breathable atmosphere. In my alien spacesuit, racing silently just above the cloud tops, there was nothing familiar or comforting around me. Nothing in sight was welcoming to warm-blooded air-breathing creatures. The view was beautiful, and its cold, unending indifference to life. Almost exactly at the 32-minute mark, I received a short, mission-successful message from Skippy. Then nothing for another 8 minutes. The 8 minutes was awful, made worse because my helmet display kept flashing a warning that I was going to hit the planet's thick atmosphere in another 39 minutes, and I didn't know how to turn the damn thing off. It was annoying. Finally, another message from Skippy. We did it, Joe. Whenever that tanker jumps, it's going to leave behind drones like a trail of breadcrumbs. And major bonus, I was able to hack into their navigation system and download data. We now know where and when the tankers will rendezvous with the surveyor ship. This mission is totally successful. Except for the part about me falling into a planet. Excellent, Skippy. Outstanding. I knew we could count on you. Sincerely. Thank you, from all of us. How are you doing? He asked. Okay so far. I tried saying that as a joke. The stupid display flashed another warning at me. A warning I didn't need. So far. Is this like the old joke about the guy who falls off a building and when he is halfway to the sidewalk below, he thinks to himself, okay, so far? Something like that, yeah, Skippy. Is there anything I can do, Joe? I don't know, Skippy, is there anything you can do? Part of me was hoping he'd thought up a brilliant plan. About the major problem, no, I got nothing. Sorry. Anything else I can do for you? You keep talking to me? Hey, I know. DJ Skippy Skip and the Fresh Tunes. Don't forget about the Fresh Tunes. I also go by Grandmaster Skip. Sure, you got it. Play some music for me, please. You have music stored in your memory, right? Human music? Uh-huh. All of it. All? Yep. Well, all that was stored in digital format while I was on Earth. What type of music do you want? It still surprised me how much data Skippy could store. While we were on Earth, he told me that he had downloaded the entire internet, including the darknet. I hadn't quite believed him. Anything. Bluegrass? Anything but bluegrass. My helmet speakers played some New Age-type, soothing instrumental thing. Something I hadn't heard before. It was nice. And appropriate. Thanks, Grandmaster Skip. He didn't reply immediately, making my heart leap with fear that something had gone wrong. Joe, he finally said, I have been alive for a very, very long time. Millions of years, I think. It just occurred to me that no matter how much longer I exist in all the infinite universes of probability, I will never talk to you again. He sounded convincingly broken up about it. His voice was unsteady. That makes me very sad. You are an incredibly arrogant, irritating, smug little shithead, Skippy. But I'm going to miss you, too. Joe, what do you want to do with your stuff? That seemed an odd question. Skippy may have been nervous and searching for something to talk about. Before I left Earth, again, I had updated my will through an army lawyer. My parents would get everything, including my back pay. The lawyer had explained that in the extremely likely event the Dutchman was never heard from again, I would be declared dead after 3 years, and my army pay would stop accruing. It sucked, but that was the deal offered to everyone in the X-4. I wouldn't get, and didn't request, special treatment.
You mean my stuff aboard the Dutchman? Lieutenant Colonel Chang will know what to do with it. There wasn't much, anyway. Hey, promise me you won't give him a hard time.
Ugh, all right. Damn, you hate me having any fun.
No worse than I give you.
Fair enough.
He simulated a sigh.
Would you like me to keep talking to you, or do you prefer silence at this time?
Talking, please.
Hey, it won't be silent when I hit the atmosphere, will it? The air particles, molecules, atoms, whatever, will start bouncing off my helmet.
And I'll hear that, I think.
You will hear sound transmitted through the outside of that helmet, yes. Very high-pitched sound at first, because you are moving at high supersonic speed. Then there will be a roaring sound. The visor that sits atop your helmet will automatically drop down and cover the faceplate to protect it. You won't have a real view then. The faceplate will switch to showing images from the exterior cameras.
I don't like that.
Can you override the visor? I want to see.
Without the visor, Skippy warned, the faceplate will deteriorate quickly.
It is made of a tough material so it won't melt, but it will fog, and you will be blinded anyway.
All right, fine. It's going to be quick, right? When I hit the atmosphere, this suit won't last long.
The cloud tops below me looked close enough for me to reach out and touch them already.
Although I want to tell you yes, the answer is no. Kristang armor is rugged. It will last longer than you expect. Or in this case, I'm very sad to say, longer than you will want. The suit will hold together long enough for you to get sufficiently deep in the atmosphere. Then the force of deceleration will crush you inside the suit. Other than your bones, your soft tissue will become a liquefied...
Guess you don't need to hear about that.
The good news is you should lose consciousness around 12 Gs.
Good news? In context, I guess it was good news.
Wow, these suits are super tough. This material can take all that heat?
No, the outer protective layers of the suit will flake off in a process called ablation. As the material heats up, it will ablate away, exposing fresh layers below. This protects the integrity of the suit, and the wearer, as long as possible. In combat, ablation technology defends the wearer against directed energy weapons such as masers and particle beams, and...
He went silent. For a moment I panicked, thinking we lost connection, except the music was still playing in my helmet speakers.
And?
Skippy?
And?
Give me a minute. I'm working on an idea here, he said excitedly. Lots of numbers to crunch. Need to run a couple billion simulations through the model I've built.
Okie dokie, I'll be right here. Got plenty of time and nothing to do.
Nothing to do was true. The plenty of time part was not.
Yes, he fairly shouted. Got it.
Joe, while I don't want you to get your hopes up too much, there is a possibility that I can do something to help.
I'm all ears here, Skippy.
Well, first thing is, you are very much not going to like this.
Skippy's idiotic plan, which I very much did not like, involved him repositioning his end of the micro-wormhole so that it was behind and slightly below me. He moved the other end of the wormhole directly in front and very close to the dropship, close enough that he instructed Desai to slide the protective shield down over the composite cockpit windows to protect the occupants from radiation. Then, and here's the part I very much did not like, he had Desai fire the dropship's maser through the wormhole. At me. When Skippy told me his plan, my first thought was that he was offering to kill me in one quick zap, so I wouldn't suffer from being crushed inside my suit. But no, that would have been too easy. Instead, the crazy little beer can planned to use pulses of maser light at reduced power to boost my speed enough so I would miss the atmosphere. Maser photons impacting my suit would flake off my suit's ablative layers, propelling me forward. All of this science-y BS was according to Skippy, who was, of course, safely out of the maser's line of fire.
What if I say no to this moronic plan of yours? I asked fearfully.
Fearing certain death, I wasn't sure whether crashing into the atmosphere still wasn't preferable to getting cooked to a crisp. When I hear maser, I think combination of laser and microwave oven. Imagine a frozen burrito getting zapped by a million watts. That's what ran through my head.
Could you repeat that, Joe? I couldn't hear you. You said go?
No, I said no.
Uh-huh. Go it is.
Got it.
Captain Desai, fire on my mark.
Three, two, one. Mark. Shit! The faceplate of my helmet automatically went opaque, and the visor slammed down. The suit went rigid, something Skippy should have told me about. I waited for imminent and painful death. It didn't happen. Skippy's plan worked. Surprised the hell out of me, that's for sure. Probably surprised him, too. He had me spin around slowly so the mazer hit different parts of the suit. He had to look, fire, look again, then repeat. The first turkey shoot, as I called it, only lasted 8 minutes because we couldn't have a mazer hitting me while either of the two Theranan ships were above the horizon. It almost didn't work. 8 minutes of being propelled by mazer only boosted my speed enough to delay me falling into the atmosphere. By the time the tanker ships went behind the curve of the planet again, I was technically already in the atmosphere, and the wormhole had started to suck in atmospheric particles and blast the dropship with high-energy radiation. Inside my suit there was occasional pinging sounds. I thought that was the air screaming past me. Skippy said it was my imagination. It sure sounded real to me. My second cooking session lasted 22 minutes and was less frightening because Skippy didn't have to rush the process. He could let my suit cool and adjust between mesa blasts. The outer layer of the suit was composed partly of nanoparticles that could move around somewhat to cover exposed areas, sections of the suit that the mesa had burned away. After the second session, before we had to stop because a tanker ship was about to rise over the horizon, Skippy declared that I was safe, that my orbital path was now good enough to keep me from plunging to my death for an hour, at least. Plenty of time for the Theranan ships to climb out of the planet's gravity well and jump away. Skippy must have been using creative math in declaring I was safe, for it still looked like I could reach out and touch the cloud tops, they were that close. Unconsciously, I was holding my breath, afraid that my chest heaving up and down would knock me out of orbit. "You sure I'm good here, Skippy?" I asked in a fearful whisper. Right then I was more frightened than I had been when I had thought death was certain. Life, the possibility that I might go on living. There, just beyond my grasp. I was terrified of having that chance snatched away from me by the cruel math of orbital mechanics. "Uh-huh," Skippy replied. "I'm sure. Math don't lie, bro. Tell you what, though. How about you don't move a muscle, stay perfectly still, and try not to breathe too hard, okay?" "Why?" "Well, the mazer really cooked your suit, and patches of it are thin as tissue paper right now. I wouldn't worry about it." "Of course you don't need to worry about it." "I see your point. Still, there is no point to you worrying. You can't do anything about it. When the dropship gets there, Captain Desai will open the airlock door and fly the dropship to take you aboard, without you having to move in any way. Once the airlock is closed and repressurized, you can move about all you wish." "How long will that be?" "Well, certainly not more than an hour, Joe." "Why's that?" "Because we can't risk hitting you with the mazer again. If those two tankers haven't jumped away within an hour, you're going to fall into the atmosphere, and this time there will be nothing I can do about it." "Oh, great." 10 minutes later, I heard a faint, high-pitched whistling sound. Remembering Skippy's scoffing when I thought I'd heard atmosphere screaming past me, I held my breath and tried to decide whether it was my imagination or not. And if not my imagination, what was it? A static hissing from my helmet speakers? "Skippy, am I hearing things again? There's a whistling noise right at the edge of my hearing." "Wow, you can hear that, Joe? Your hearing is impressive. That frequency is almost up in the dog hearing range." "You know about it?" "Damn that beer can. What is it? Can you turn it off? It is very distracting." "No can do, sorry. I can't turn it off because it's a tiny air leak. Well, not so tiny as it was a few minutes ago." "What? Crap, you knew about this? Why didn't you tell me?" "There was no reason to worry you about it. Well, not yet, anyway." "Skippy," I said, exasperated with him, "my air supply is leaking out into space. I have a very good reason to be worried." "Worrying is not going to solve the problem, Joe." "What will solve the problem?" "I am working on it. The suit has been instructed to move nanoparticles to plug the leak. So far, it isn't working. The suit's supply of nanoparticles has been severely depleted, and the remaining supply is already being used to prevent the suit from springing other leaks. Probably shouldn't have told you about that." That was not good news at all. "Understood. I have plenty of oxygen, right? Enough to keep me breathing, even with this, as you say, tiny leak?" "Ah, not so much, unfortunately. The suit mostly and efficiently recycles oxygen. There is a small reserve oxygen bottle. The bottle is inadequate, considering the leak.
I kept silent for a moment, listening hard. The sound was not so high-pitched now. The leak must have gotten bigger.
Where is the leak? Can I put my hand over it or something like that?
I can't do nothing, Skippy. The leak is near your waist, on the left side. Do not move. Moving will only make the leak worse and cause other leaks.
Great. Wonderful.
What can I do?
Try to breathe less?
Very funny. That wasn't a joke.
Shit.
Perhaps I should work on my humor so you know when I'm joking.
You think?
Sorry, Skippy said, sounding genuinely sorry. A leak. How to stop a leak. If only this Kristang suit came with something like a can of Fix-A-Flat. Although it did, in the form of nanoparticles that could plug leaks, make minor repairs, reinforce thin areas, and all kinds of useful things. Absent-mindedly, while feverishly trying to think of a way to stop a leak, I turned my head and took a sip from the water supply tube in the helmet. Dry. I'd sipped the last of the water an hour ago.
Huh, I said.
Skippy, I may have an idea.
An idea? You?
This I have to hear. Would water plug the leak? It would freeze, right? Make a plug of ice to cover the hole.
Not exactly. The water would freeze and boil at the same time because of the combination of cold and zero pressure.
Besides, Joe, you drank all the water, you dumb monkey. There's none left.
There's no pure water left.
Oh. You know what I'm thinking? Down next to my left leg was a pee bag that we'd installed before I took my many hours long space dive.
Unfortunately, yuck.
Yes. I can puncture the bag with nanoparticles.
Do that.
Ugh. I felt my leg growing wet. Then the wetness moved up my hips.
It's working, Joe, Skippy said excitedly.
It's boiling off slowly, which is not a problem. There's plenty more.
Good idea, Joe.
Yes. Outstanding. Hey, Skippy, this little incident, this can stay just between us, right?
No need to tell anybody about it.
Yeah, like that's gonna happen, he chuckled. No way can I pass up a golden opportunity to leak this info, he laughed gleefully.
Crap. Can you hit me with the maser again?
The whole time I was waiting, I was angrily urging the two Theranan ships to get off their asses and move away from the planet. What the hell were they waiting for?
Damn.
It was like getting stuck on a two-lane road behind a school bus and you can't pass. The damn thing stops at every freaking mailbox and you have to sit there watching the flashing lights and you wish the driver would just move faster or take a turn or pull over so you can pass. You're stuck behind the school bus, and it's crawling along, and it ever so slowly grinds to a stop at a driveway, and one kid is waiting there with his mommy, and the kid slouches up the steps and walks slowly back to the seat with his mommy waving idiotically to him the whole way. He meanders down the aisle of the bus, and then when you think the stupid kid has finally sat down and the bus can move again, the school bus driver decides to chat with the mommy, and you're tempted to lean on your car horn because you want that bus to just get the hell out of your way already. That ever happened to you? I pictured the tanker crews climbing their steps out to jump distance, and then deciding a celebration was in order, or something broke on their stupid ships, and they were fiddling around trying to fix it, while I slowly but surely fell toward the clouds below me. Maybe the Theranan were having a cake and ice cream and singing songs or some nonsense like that. Skippy assured me the two tankers were moving at their best speed and would jump as soon as possible. The Theranan, being cyborgs, didn't go much for celebrations. When they finally did jump away 34 minutes later, I almost shouted for joy. Mercifully, Desai put the pedal to the metal on the dropship's engines to rescue me. Instead, I ordered Skippy to signal the Dutchman to jump into orbit and for Desai to come pick us up. The dropship was suddenly close to us, Desai making no effort at stealth. She was burning the engines at full power.
"Desai, take Skippy aboard first," I ordered.
"Sir?" she asked, surprised.
"Mr. Skippy said your suit is in bad condition."
"That is true. It is also true that Skippy is more important to the mission than I am. If the Theranan come back or whatever, I want him aboard first in case you need to hightail it out of here. That's an order." Over Skippy's protests, Giroux grappled the jetpack, released Skippy, then took him aboard and let the jetpack drift away.
The dropship then flew over to me, and Desai slowly and carefully edged the dropship sideways until Giraud was able to very gently guide me into the airlock door with his fingertips.
"Got him," Giraud told Desai. "Closing the door now."
The airlock quickly filled with sweet, breathable air, and as the inner door slid open, I reached up to take my helmet off.
"Desai, we shouldn't leave that jetpack floating around as evidence we were here. Can you blast it with a maser?"
"Oh, yes, sir."
There, done. It's a cloud of vapor now.
Great. Man, I was tired. My hair was plastered to my head with dried sweat. Giraud handed me a bottle of water, and I drank it eagerly.
Desai wrinkled her nose.
"What's that smell?"
"The suit got cooked a bit by the maser," I explained.
"No,"
she shook her head.
"It smells like..."
"As a problem solver," Skippy laughed, "Joe is number one."
"Skippy,
when a problem needs to be solved, Joe doesn't waste any time trying to piss up a rope."
"All right, Skippy.
Joe knows you can't put out a forest fire by peeing on it, but you can."
"Enough," I shouted.
"The maser busted the, you know, bag," I explained, and pointed to the suit's left leg.
It sounded lame to me.
"Screw it."
"Yeah,"
Skippy snorted. "Uh-huh. That's our story, and we're sticking to it."
"Desai," I said wearily, "I'm getting out of this suit, then I'm going to towel off and change my clothes. My signal won't reach the Dutchman for another hour anyway."
Chapter 31 While we waited for the Dutchman to arrive and retrieve us, Skippy downloaded the data from the two drones the tanker had unwittingly dropped off before it jumped. To our great relief, we'd been successful. Both drones indicated the tankers had jumped to a point consistent with Skippy's hacked data, about the location and time where the two tankers planned to rendezvous with the surveyor ship and a destroyer that would be acting as escort. I was worried that the rendezvous location would be only a vague area of empty interstellar space, that the four ships of the Surveyor Task Force might jump into an area half the size of a solar system, and then we'd have to try chasing them down one by one. Skippy assured us the Theranin were much too competitive for that kind of behavior. Their navigators prided themselves on accuracy and hitting targeted jump points, so we would be able to count on them jumping into their designated points within 8,000 kilometers. Even the big clumsy tankers could be counted on to be accurate. That was good news. In the bad news department, Skippy explained that Theranin practice for a task force rendezvous, even deep inside Theranin territory, was for a warship to jump into the rendezvous point first, so we could count on having to deal with the destroyer before the softer targets. That ruined my hopes of us blasting the vulnerable tankers, then the surveyor, and then firing at the destroyer a few times to make it look good before we jumped safely away. However it was we dealt with the Surveyor Task Force, we needed to kill or disable a Theranin destroyer first. How the hell we were going to do that in our rebuilt star carrier was a damn good question. I had an idea, the unformed kernel of an idea. I needed to think more on it before mentioning it to anyone, especially Skippy. The last thing I wanted was to give that arrogant little beer can even more reason to be smug by shooting down a plan I hadn't thought all the way through. I needed time to think. And I needed to get out of my sweat and other fluid-soaked clothes. And I needed a shower. Seriously. When the Dutchman jumped into orbit, it still took the dropship 40 minutes to match speed and course rendezvous with her. I gave Sims, as the duty officer on the bridge, an order to jump the star carrier as soon as our dropship was secured in the landing bay. With the jump successful, I let Sims know I'd be on the bridge soon, and brought Skippy with me to my cabin, sitting him on a shelf while I got in the shower. As the hot water of the shower cascaded over me, washing away the grime from my space dive, I relaxed and was able to think clearly. Out of the shower, I toweled off and sat on the bed a minute before putting on a fresh uniform.
"Skippy, that didn't go exactly as planned, but we did accomplish the mission. Your master idea was a stroke of genius. Thank you for that."
"No problem, Joe. If you're not here, who will amuse me with monkey-brained ideas?"
"Yeah.
Speaking of monkey-brained ideas, you know where each of those four ships are going to jump into, right? Pretty precisely? And you know when, also?"
"Yep, I told you that."
"You said mission accomplished. I do not think it is entirely accurate. We only accomplished the first, less important part of the mission. We know where those ships will be meeting and when. We still have to attack those ships, and we do not have a realistic plan. Hell, any plan for doing that. Not a problem. I got that covered. Not a problem, he says. Skippy sounded skeptical. Skippy, while I was space diving by myself, I did some thinking. You? Thinking? I find that hard to believe, but sure, what the hell? Surprise me. I came up with a plan for us to destroy all four of those ships, or at least three of them. One of the tankers may get away. That shouldn't be a problem. Letting one tanker get away, if it thinks we're a giraffe, the cruiser might actually be useful to us. A monkey plan. Does this involve, let me guess, magic bananas? Nope. No bananas at all. Damn, Joe, what fun is that? More fun than no plan at all, which is what we have right now. Unless you have some super genius idea of your own with your ginormous brain. No, I told you. I don't see any way the Flying Dutchman can be successful in combat with a destroyer. Or the Surveyor. I don't see how we could even survive combat. Easy, Skippy. We will survive and be successful. Because we're not going to risk the Dutchman in combat. Silence. Then, can I assume you do not plan to simply ask the Theranin to surrender? Because no way would the Theranin be intimidated by this bucket. We would need a much meaner-looking ship. This is why gangsters never drive a minivan, Joe. I mean, come on. How intimidated would you be by a guy driving a minivan with one of those stupid baby-on-board signs and sticky Cheerios all over the back seat? I had to laugh, imagining in my head a group of tough gangbangers rolling through the hood in a beige minivan. Nope, we are not asking the Theranin to surrender. I plan to hit those ships with missiles right as they come out of jump at the rendezvous. We will park missiles around the enemy jump target points with the missiles programmed to hit a ship as it emerges from the wormhole. We'll hit the destroyer first. You told me ships have to drop their stealth and defensive shields to go through a jump wormhole, so that destroyer will be vulnerable as it emerges, right? About that part of your plan, yeah, sure, you're correct. Ships are at their most vulnerable coming out of a jump. They don't have shields up, and their sensor fields are scrambled by quantum fluctuations of the wormhole. They're almost blind. So, yes, if you could predict exactly where a ship will emerge from a jump, you can hit it precisely. Even a single missile would destroy or severely cripple a warship. Now, with those obvious facts established, may I point out the annoying little detail of the fatal flaw in your genius plan? Skippy's voice had a mocking tone. You're going to anyway, right? That's affirmative. We're supposed to target the missiles toward the precise point where the Theranin ships would emerge from their jump, huh? The problem with that plan is we do not know exactly where the Theranin will jump in. The rendezvous coordinates for each ship are only accurate to within a radius of 8,000 kilometers, because that is the limit of accuracy of Theranin jump navigation technology. Even if we used all our missiles to saturate the spherical area where a single ship is likely to jump in, it will take any missile too long to detect the ship and close for impact. The target area is too large. Assuming the Theranin are accurate to within 8,000 kilometers of the target, that is an enormous volume of space to cover. The formula for the volume of a sphere is the radius cubed times... Oh, wait. Why am I trying to explain even simple math to you? Joe, a radius of 8,000 kilometers leaves a sphere of over 2 trillion cubic kilometers to search. While a missile is closing from that distance, the ship would detect the threat and jump away or raise shields. So, your plan won't work. Dumbass. Uh-huh. What if we could shrink the area where a ship is likely to jump in? Shrink it to, say... 100 cubic kilometers or less. Oh, sure, if you're asking for miracles. Why don't you ask for fairy elves to fly in on a unicorn and take care of that problem for us? That would be more realistic. Thanks a bunch for the vote of confidence in my predictive abilities, but even my awesomely ginormous brain power can't tell you where a ship is going to jump in with that level of accuracy. There are too many variables in a particular ship's jump drive at that exact moment. The charge energy, how many coils are in use, the level of calibration of how the entire system works together. We get the idea, Skippy, a lot of variables, yup. We're not going to guess. We're going to game the system by cheating. Beat the house. Oh, you know me, Joey. I'm all about cheating the laws of physics. However, give me a minute, please. I want to get popcorn and an ice-cold brewski. That way I can sit back on the couch and savor the moment while you make a complete and total fool of yourself with whatever moronic so-called idea your monkey brain has dreamed up. Okay, I'm ready. Hit me with your best shot. Ha ha, this is going to be great. You can warp space-time, right? What you're going to do for us is create an especially flat area of space-time, inside the radius where we know the ship will try to jump in. When that ship projects the far end of its jump wormhole, that wormhole will be attracted to the flattest spot in the target area by default. That's because the spot requires the lowest energy state to form a stable wormhole, or some other science-y physics BS like that you told me once when I was actually paying attention. We will be able to predict almost exactly where a ship will jump in. Will that work? Skippy didn't answer. He didn't say anything at all. Skippy, I asked. Hey, are you crunching numbers in there? Finally, he said simply, Holy shit. Yep. You are such an asshole. I hate you. He genuinely sounded hurt. Damn it. Got it. Is that a yes? However Skippy emulated a heartfelt sigh, it was convincing. Yes. Damn it. Ugh, I hate my life. A monkey has a good idea. A freaking monkey. Unbelievable. The universe is so unfair. Yes, it will work, Joe. I can control where a ship jumps to within less than 100 kilometers. Nowhere near as accurate as I am with our own jumps, of course. There are too many variables I can't analyze without being on the enemy ship before it jumps. 100, even 1,000 kilometers is close enough. Our missiles will be able to target and hit the enemy ship before it can detect the missiles and raise shields. Any ship jumping in will be a sitting duck. And hey, in case you think you're so freaking smart, I'm not going to create an especially flat area of space-time. What I'm going to do is create an area where the flatness is negative. Now he had me puzzled. Negative flatness? Isn't that a fancy way of saying it's curved in the other direction? No. Ask one of your scientist monkeys to explain it to you if they can. For them, figuring out how the universe really works will be simple compared to explaining quantum topology to you. He was entirely right about that, by the way. Because we had time while we jumped toward the rendezvous point, I stopped by the science lab to ask a team of human brainiacs how flatness could be negative. My thought was that Skippy had been screwing with me. Damn. It was like sitting next to a grandmother and asking to see pictures of her grandchildren, which, of course, no one would ever do unless they were insane, because any grandmother can inflict at least several hours of suffocating boredom while talking about her grandchildren. After the third photo and hearing about the mundane accomplishments of little Maddie or Timmy, the unfortunate listener starts wishing fondly for the sweet, sweet release of death. How come heart attacks never happen when you need one? Anyway, our team of scientists were more than happy to attempt explaining quantum topology to me, which should have been my first warning sign. They were especially excited because their understanding of the subject had taken a great leap forward during their time aboard the Dutchman, and they couldn't wait to show off their newly acquired insights. Somebody, they were certain, was getting the Nobel Prize when we got home. I didn't have the heart to remind them that getting home was still more of an if than a when. They tried. They really tried. The fourth time our resident rocket scientist Dr. Friedlander attempted to explain why X is the cube value of the mu function, I mentally gave up. Skippy mercifully took pity on me at that point, for which I was forever grateful. He faked an emergency that required me to rush away to the bridge. That was the last time I was going to ask scientists to explain science to me. It was best for everyone involved. We dropped off 4 missiles, surrounding the spot where the Theranan destroyer was supposed to emerge from its jump into the rendezvous point, then backed the Dutchman away half a light second and engaged her stealth field and defensive shield. The missiles were hot, programmed to target the wormhole. They would go to full acceleration as soon as they detected a ship emerging without waiting for a signal from the Dutchman. The missiles would operate in pairs. 2 would engage first, and if they scored hits, the other 2 missiles would stand down. We didn't have missiles to waste. If even 1 missile scored a direct hit on the destroyer, especially on that ship's aft engineering section, the destroyer would be a sitting duck to be carved up by the Dutchman's comparatively weak maser cannons. All we needed was 1 precise missile or maser strike on a reactor or charged jump drive coils, and the destroyer would become a cloud of particles. Our own drive coils would be fully charged, so we could perform a micro jump if the destroyer was merely damaged and able to shoot back, or a major jump if the whole idea somehow didn't work. Skippy did his science-y physics trick with creating an especially flat spot in space-time in the exact center of our ring of missiles, and then we waited. And waited. While, thanks to Skippy, we knew precisely where the Theranan destroyer was going to jump in, We knew when, only within a span of 10 hours. To be safe, we arrived at the rendezvous point 26 hours early. That was as fast as we could get there, considering we were racing two slow, lumbering tanker ships to the same place. We arrived, scanned the whole region intensely until Skippy declared it was clear, and we parked our missiles and positioned the Dutchman near where the destroyer was supposed to jump in. And waited. When the destroyer arrived, it was almost anticlimactic for us humans. The whole thing happened faster than the blink of an eye. Skippy assured us the whole thing was prodigiously, bodaciously awesome. I had to take his word for it until he replayed the sensor data on the display for us in extra super-duper slow motion. The far end of the destroyer's jump wormhole appeared first, appearing on the screen as gamma radiation in spectacular false colors. Skippy took some artistic license with that for our benefit. The wormhole was microscopic at first. Skippy drew 3D crosshairs in the display, showing that the wormhole was less than 30 kilometers from the target jump area, right where Skippy had created area of extra flat spacetime. The next thing we noticed on the display was not the wormhole expanding, or the nose of the destroyer emerging. It was two of our missiles accelerating hard, straight for the wormhole. Skippy had programmed them to home in initially on the gamma radiation of a wormhole opening, and the missiles did not hesitate at all. By the time the wormhole had expanded and the nose of the destroyer came into view, our missiles had closed half the distance already and had switched their targeting to the hull of the destroyer. Both missiles impacted the destroyer's aft section almost simultaneously. When I later ran the display back and let it run forward nanosecond by nanosecond, it still looked like they hit at the same time. One missile hit a reactor. Its warhead ripped through the reactor shielding like it wasn't there. We could see fragments of the warhead coming out the other side of the ship like a fountain, spewing white-hot particles out into space. That dramatic view was brief, because the other missile scored a direct hit on a cluster of jump drive coils and released their stored energy in a catastrophic flash. It happened so fast even Skippy wasn't sure whether that missile's warhead had time to explode on its own. Either way, the destroyer was instantly vaporized, and Desai had to trigger a short jump to protect the Dutchman from high-energy debris. One down, three to go. Our concern then was the Theranin might somehow have figured out our awesome new gimmick, and our incredible advantage would turn into a one-trick pony. We recovered the two unused missiles quickly. They had nicks and scratches from the exploding destroyer. Skippy assured us the missiles would work just fine. Then we jumped over to where the surveyor ship was supposed to jump in and parked the extra missiles there. We had previously parked missiles around the target jump points for the surveyor and the two tankers. Those three ships were scheduled to jump in anywhere from 20 minutes to 6 hours after the destroyer. We didn't know the exact timing. All we knew was the surveyor would jump in first. We need to kill the surveyor ship and at least one of the tankers. We almost did it. The second ship to jump in was the surveyor, which in the super slow motion replay looked a lot like the Flying Dutchman did now, a much shortened star carrier. Except the surveyor's aft section was noticeably larger, with additional reactors and fuel tanks and other gear needed for extreme long-range voyages. Replay was the only good look we got at the surveyor. Our missiles smoked it as soon as it emerged from its jump wormhole. It made a considerably bigger explosion than the destroyer had. Big enough that the two extra missiles we had hanging around the target jump point on standby got pelted with debris so badly, we had to order them to self-destruct. Taking them back aboard in their damaged condition would be much too risky to the Dutchman. Even a tiny breach in the containment system of an atomic compression warhead could result in the atoms being no longer quite so compressed. Two down, two to go, and the remaining two were not really warships. There were tight, self-conscious smiles and quickly flashed thumbs-ups going around the bridge and CIC, people needing to release tension and celebrate just a little, balanced with not wanting to jinx us by breaking into cheers too early. The surveyor ship would not be going to Earth or going anywhere. Our mission was not yet complete. We needed to destroy at least one of the tankers to sell our cover story of the surveyor task force being attacked by the Giratha. Without that, the Theranin might become suspicious about why the surveyor ship was prevented from going to Earth and render our entire plan useless. It almost worked. The tankers, despite traveling together, didn't jump into the rendezvous together. Their crews, Skippy said, likely had a rivalry, each crew wanting their ship to jump in closer to the target location, so each ship had been meticulously careful about calibrating jump drives and plotting the far end of their wormholes. Because in this case, Skippy had to project two spots of extra flat spacetime, and though spots were separated by 150,000 kilometers, that strained even his awesome abilities. I know his abilities were awesome because he told us several times, at least. One of the tanker crews finished screwing with their jump drive slightly before the other ship, because one tanker jumped in before the other one. On the display, we saw the familiar flare of gamma radiation as the wormhole's far end opened and the bulbous front end of the tanker emerged from the wormhole. The trouble started when our first missile impacted. It hit the center of the tanker, not the aft end. Skippy later admitted he should have programmed those missiles to anticipate the tankers coming through the wormhole more ponderously than the Surveyor and the Destroyer had. Momentum carried the ass end of the tanker forward through the wormhole, even as the center of the ship broke apart. All this happened in a split second. We only realized what happened later by examining playback of the sensor data. The second and last missile, targeted at the first tanker, did manage to hit a reactor on the aft end of the ship, and loss of reactor containment ruptured a bank of charged jump drive coils, effectively vaporizing most of that ship. Unfortunately, in order to hit the vital aft end of the ship, our second smart missile had been forced to dive slightly into the wormhole itself. The missile knew the configuration of the ship, saw how comparatively slow it was traveling through the wormhole, and the missile concluded its best chance of hitting something vital was to curve around and dive into the wormhole itself. In retrospect, I wish that missile had not been quite so overeager for an outstanding rating on its next performance review, for its quick thinking caused a big headache for us. When our missile dove into the open wormhole and caused release of energy stored in the jump drive coils of the first tanker, it also alerted the second tanker that something was wrong, very wrong, with its sister ship, and that jumping to where the first ship went might not be so healthy for the second ship. Destruction of the jump drive coils caused blowback through the near end of the ship's jump wormhole, a distinctive burst of gamma radiation that was immediately noticed by the second tanker, and that ship's navigation AI automatically aborted its own jump wormhole as it was forming. The command crew of the second tanker wasted no time in redirecting their jump to alternate coordinates and jumped instead to an unknown location. Oh, Skippy said, and that was my first indication that anything was wrong. Destruction of the first tanker, like the Destroyer and Surveyor before it, had happened too fast for the human eye to follow. As far as I knew, everything was going great. Unsuspecting enemy ships were jumping in unawares and almost instantly becoming fireballs. To my eye, I couldn't have been more proud. I thought of an idea that destroyed the enemy and secured the future of Earth and humanity without my own ship being placed at risk at all. It was all good. I was wondering whether, against orders, Major Sims had a bottle of champagne hidden away somewhere. So great was my confidence and complacency that when Skippy spoke, I figured it was to complain about a missile hitting a nanometer away from where he'd planned, something only a super-intelligent AI would care about. Uh-oh. What's going wrong in the world of Skippy? I asked distractedly, my eyes glued to the display, anticipating the second tanker to jump in any second, jump in, and be obliterated. Something is wrong in the world of monkeys, Colonel Joe. We have a potential problem. A quick glance around the main display told me nothing was wrong with the Dutchman's major systems. What the hell was Skippy talking about? A potential problem? You're not sure if it's a problem or not? Whether or not it is a problem depends on your mission parameters. Before you ask more stupid monkey-brained questions, I'll lay out the issue for you. The second tanker is very likely not going to jump into the rendezvous. The first tanker exploded while it was partly in the wormhole. It hadn't fully cleared the event horizon. Backblast would have been visible on the other end of the wormhole. No way could the second tanker have missed that event. Ah, shit. Suddenly I didn't feel much like drinking champagne. So? Sims asked from the CIC. We were almost hoping one of the tankers would survive to carry our cover story back to the Theranin. Correct, Major, I responded. The problem here is that tanker won't be carrying our cover story of a Giraffe the Task Force marauding through Theranin territory. They're going to have a much more interesting tale to tell. A ship gets hit while it is still inside a jump wormhole. When they hear that, the Theranin command is going to want to know how an enemy could possibly know precisely where a ship will emerge from a jump, and you can bet they'll investigate. Every sentient species in the galaxy will want to know how we pulled off that trick, even if they don't know who did it yet. We don't want to leave any mystery behind. We need the destruction of the Surveyor and its escorts to be seen as a routine military action, something that happens frequently enough in war, and not anything worth anyone taking a second look at. We need to find that second tanker. Skippy, you know where the other end of that wormhole is, right? Plot a jump for those coordinates. Course laid in, but I expect the second tanker jumped away to an alternate destination already as soon as it saw something went wrong with its sister ship.
Well, crap, Skippy, that's no good. We need to get there before its outbound wormhole fades away so we can track where it jumped to.
Pilot, I ordered to Desai. Jump as soon as you're ready.
Aye, Captain, Desai acknowledged.
We jumped to where the first tanker had tried to jump in from, immediately engaged our stealth field, and began hammering away with an active sensor search to determine whether there were any ships in the area. The stealth field was on so other ships couldn't find us. We had it active so other ships wouldn't see that the Dutchman was not, in fact, the Jurapta cruiser that we pretended to be. Sensor sweeps came back blank. The area was empty. Skippy began scanning for a residual wormhole signature and found one quickly.
Uh-oh. I was worried about this. That tanker jumped away like we thought. Problem is, it used space combat protocol for the jump. Remember how I told you ships can mess with their jump wormhole signatures, make it harder for a pursuing ship to determine where they jumped to? That's what that tanker did. As it went through the jump wormhole, it dropped off quantum resonators, the kind of like the crude flares your military aircraft use to confuse heat-seeking missiles. These quantum resonator devices disturb remnant waves of the outbound wormhole. That makes it difficult to figure out the original configuration of the wormhole. Difficult even for me.
So you can't do it? I asked anxiously. This was our first space battle where we were the pursuing ship. It required a complete change in thinking.
I can do it. I can't do it with the accuracy we would prefer. Fortunately, the Theranin are still under the mistaken impression that quantum effects tend toward randomness, a common misconception of lesser-developed species. Because I know how the universe really works, I've been able to map the pattern of the quantum resonators, unwind their effect from the residual wormhole signature, and make a reasonably good guess as to where that second tanker ship went. By reasonable, I mean I can tell where that ship jumped to within 600,000 kilometers.
Great. A glance at the main bridge display told me we had plenty of charge for an immediate jump.
Program a jump for us and we will...
Wait. There is some extra good news, Colonel Joe, Skippy said.
By some stroke of luck, or luck as you monkeys think of it, that second tanker is the one I infected when we flew by on our space dive, so it will be dropping off drones as it jumps. That makes it much easier to follow. I'm pinging the drones now, and...
Yes, got a response. I know exactly where the ship is.
That's interesting. It's going to a secondary rendezvous point. It is supposed to go to the secondary rendezvous if there is trouble at the original rendezvous location.
Oh, darn it. The tanker is probably there already, and it's supposed to remain there almost 6 hours. After that, the tanker's orders, if no other ships appear at the secondary rendezvous, is for it to make its way back to its base star system using a random course.
Damn it. We won't be able to use our neat trick of knowing exactly where a ship will jump in.
No, I said slowly while thinking.
But we do know from the drone pretty much exactly where that ship is now, right?
Within 10, 12,000 kilometers, most likely, yes.
Good. Great. This is perfect. If that ship does escape us, I don't want it to see us trying to use that trick again. Here's what we're going to do. We jump into where that ship is and launch missiles as soon as we clear the wormhole. We can project a damping field, right, to prevent the tanker from jumping away?
A weak damping field, yes. I had to disassemble much of that unit's mechanism to repair the ship.
You are proposing we act like a real pirate ship.
Something like that, yeah.
I love it. Jump course plotted and programmed in. Missiles are ready for launch.
Chapter 32. It almost worked like I hoped it would. Our jump to the secondary rendezvous point was spot on. We emerged within 7,000 kilometers from the tanker, better than Skippy hoped. Our missiles were away even before we detected the tanker. Unfortunately, that ship was on a hair trigger to jump, and it fired up its jump drive as soon as it picked up the gamma-ray burst of our inbound jump. It caught the edge of our damping field, so it wasn't able to jump far, and Skippy quickly pinged the drones it dropped off. We abandoned our two missiles, even though we were running low on missiles. We jumped after the tanker within 40 seconds of jumping into the secondary rendezvous. This time we skipped launching precious missiles blindly and relied on our damping field. We emerged within 4,000 kilometers. The tanker tried to jump, but at that distance it was trapped. An attempted jump would have ripped apart its jump drive coils and effectively destroyed the tanker for us. The tanker crew didn't have the magic of Skippy working for them. With the tanker unable to jump away, it was a straight-up firefight, a tanker against a partly rebuilt star carrier. "Weapons free," I ordered, and the CIC crew responded by locking maser cannons on target and hammering away at the tanker's defensive shields with scissors.